Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I think we might start the meeting now. My name is Richard Holm, and I'm chairman of the Hansard Society, and it's my very pleasant job to welcome you all to the third Hansard Society annual lecture. We have, of course, an extremely distinguished lecturer this evening in the shape of Robin Cook, but before I introduce him, let me just reassure you about these two bottles here, which may look to you as though they're Van Rosé. In fact, somebody was suggesting to me that they thought the Lord Chancellor was doing the lecture this evening, but of course it isn't. It's the Leader of the House. They aren't. They're mineral water, rather disappointingly. And that brings me naturally onto the subject of our sponsor. I'd like to introduce Ian Burns, who's the Chief Executive of the Stationery Office. And before I introduce him, to thank him very much indeed. This is the second time that the Stationery Office have sponsored the Hansard Society lecture, and we're very grateful for your support, Ian, and we're glad to hear from you now.
Lord Holm, Mr. Cook, ladies and gentlemen. The Stationery Office is delighted to be sponsoring tonight's lecture on modernisation of Parliament. TSO itself has also been modernising, and while we continue to do all the things we have been doing for government and Parliament for 200 years, can you believe, we are constantly being challenged to do new things and to do things differently. And the pace of change, of course, is always getting faster. We still put ink on paper for a vast majority of government departments and for Parliament, but our core business is information management in the broadest sense. Managing official information from its creation to its ultimate target destination in all media and in all formats. In the information age, this means we have to embrace such ideas as metadata integration, information architecture, knowledge management, interoperability, connectivity, those and many other terms in the e-commerce world. It really is increasingly a digital world. But as I'm sure the Leader of the House will be telling us, successful modernisation is about combining the best of the old with the challenges and the opportunities of today's and tomorrow's world. We in TSO are proud that Parliament has recognised that it is receiving better information management and publisher services than it ever has done, and at lower cost. We like to think that we service our clients' current needs, exceeding always their expectations, and that we also work with them in partnership in anticipating and delivering to their future requirements. We look forward to hearing from the Leader of the House for his thoughts and plans on modernisation of an institution admired and emulated all over the world. We trust that we will continue to play a pivotal role as Parliament's partner in developing and delivering process change as it embraces that modernisation. As ever, we stand ready to serve. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those words, Ian, and thank you again for your generous and very helpful sponsorship. Now it's my very great pleasure to introduce the Leader of the House of Commons. I think it's fair to say that since Robin Cook became Leader of the House of Commons, all of us, and it certainly includes the Hansard Society, who hope to see Parliament more rational, more understandable and more accessible, have had our spirits lifted. Great hopes are invested in you, Robin, not least from this society, and it's a very great pleasure to welcome you here and to invite you to speak to us. Robin Cook.
Thank you, Richard, and can I just add to our sponsors that I'm delighted to be here sponsored by the Station Office, who have been responsible for printing my speeches for 30 years. On the whole, very faithfully, and congratulations. There was one embarrassing moment when I was foreign secretary, when I did once say, we have serious human rights concerns with Turkmenistan and Tajikistan. which unfortunately was printed the next day, as we see as human rights concerns with Turkey and Pakistan. And all hell broke loose in the diplomatic community before we could get the records corrected. But on the whole, things have gone very well between us, and I'm delighted to further that partnership tonight. Tonight, Richard, I want to talk about the health of our democracy. As leader of the House, you would expect me to begin on such a subject with a medical bulletin on the health of Parliament. But I hope to go wider than that and look at the changing pressures on our democracy and the changing character of political debate. Let's begin, though, with Parliament. You'll find me tonight in an optimistic mood about the regeneration of Parliament. The past month has seen a series of decisions that together reinforce the status of Parliament. Perhaps the largest of those was the announcement last week that the government will put Parliament in the driving seat on the road to reform of the House of Lords through a free vote in both houses. I was encouraged that Charter 88... Am I allowed to mention rivals? Yes, that's what I'm saying. I was encouraged to see that Charter 88 welcomed the announcement as a victory for those campaigning for a democratic UK. And it is indeed possible that it will result in a more democratic second chamber, as the Public Administration Select Committee identified a mainly elected second chamber as the preference with the largest support among members of Parliament. And it is right that the starting point of this parliamentary process on reform of the Lords should be a joint committee of backbenchers from both houses. It will not be easy to build consensus, but we are more likely to establish where the centre of gravity for reform lies among a committee representative of Parliament than through a decision imposed by government. The first phase of the committee's work will be to define the range of options and composition which will be put to those free votes. After the two houses have spoken in those votes on the principle of composition, the joint committee must return to consideration of the detailed implementation of the new House. Richard, these, of course, are not new or untrodden paths that the Joint Committee is being asked to explore. As far back as 1911, Lloyd George brought in the Parliament Act to curb powers of the House of Lords, and in its preamble he asserted, "It is intended to substitute for the House of Lords as presently constituted a second chamber constituted on a popular instead of a hereditary basis." But such a substitution cannot immediately be brought into operation. Lloyd George was certainly proved right in the last assertion. 90 years and 20 general elections later, we have still not achieved that popular basis for the House of Lords. At least we have rehearsed all the possible arguments about it. Although people like me try very hard to come up with new arguments, in truth, there is nothing new to be said about House of Lords reform. And therefore, I hope that with goodwill and sober application, it will be possible for the Joint Committee to complete its work by the end of this year. I said there was a series of steps. The second step that has encouraged me recently is the decision by Tony Blair to give evidence twice a year to the Liaison Committee, which brings together the chairs of all select committees. This is an historic increase in accountability to Parliament. No Prime Minister has ever before agreed to be questioned by Parliament's committees of scrutiny. I am warned by a vigilant clerk that it's not strictly accurate to say that no Prime Minister has ever appeared before a select committee. I am advised that in the era of Ramsay MacDonald, Prime Ministers doubled up as leaders of the House. Must indeed have been busy people, come to think of it. And as such would appear before the Procedure Committee. However, that does not remove the central point that no previous Prime Minister has ever volunteered to answer questions from any of our investigative select committees. And this step by the Prime Minister neatly complements the third major move forward, the reforms that we have just made to the system of departmental select committees. The changes that were agreed last week provide the select committees with specialist staff, administrative help, and the lead role in scrutinising draft legislation in advance of it being laid before the Commons. This package of measures will significantly strengthen their ability to hold ministers to account and adds up to the most important set of changes to the Select Committee system since departmental committees were introduced 20 years ago. And the fourth item of evidence which I produce of progress in the health of Parliament is the recent announcement to make the parliamentary lobby more transparent and open not only to journalists with membership of the exclusive club. It is a bold task to take on the parliamentary lobby. I found the reaction of one of the doyens of the lobby rather extravagant when he wrote last Friday, "The lobby is doomed. Alistair has sentenced us to a slow death by openness and transparency." Now, as openness and transparency is what the media are forever urging on everyone else, especially the government, I'm perplexed that the members of the lobby should feel so threatened when this is demanded of themselves. It must be right in a modern democracy for the public to be able to see on the record the morning briefing by government and not have it mediated through a small privileged group who have the select credentials. And it cannot be right that specialist journalists who are experts on the story of the day are prevented from attending or putting their questions. Well, one point I can offer some reassurance to the lobby. When we announced this to them about 3 weeks ago, one of the members of the lobby did express concern that they might be squeezed out of the questioning by journalists from Czechoslovakia. I'm very happy to assure them there's no danger of that, since Czechoslovakia divided a decade ago. Fifthly and lastly, I can confirm that we are making good progress in the Modernisation Committee on the Agenda for Modernisation, which I published last December, and which set up my programme for reform. And I'd like, if I may, to dwell a bit on my ambitions for that programme for reform. I want to see more government bills published in draft. The truth is that by the time both parties have wheeled their heavy artillery up to the dispatch box for the set piece exchanges at second reading, the battle lines have been drawn too firmly to allow for much rethinking. If we want Parliament really to shape the character of legislation, it must get in on the act much earlier at the time of a draft bill. I want a mechanism to permit the carryover of a bill from one parliamentary year to the next, to allow a longer time for Parliament to carry out its scrutiny. The present situation prescribes that every bill must finish in November or perish with the winter frost. In those circumstances, leaders of the House will always be forced to rush legislation through Parliament. If we want longer for Parliament to consider legislation, we have to allow Parliament to carry bills forward from 1 year to the next year. I want an earlier start to the day in Parliament so that we can rescue key events in the Commons, such as ministerial statements or the opening speeches of the main debate, from the relative obscurity in the late afternoon slot. And we can rescue the key votes in Parliament from late evening when it is too late even for the last bulletin. And I want more flexible procedures so that exchanges in the chamber can be more topical. If we had wanted to prevent the Commons from being topical, we could not have come up with a more clever barrier than requiring a fortnight's notice of any oral question. But for example, during the recent fighting in Jenin, it was not in order for MPs to raise that crisis at Foreign Office question time because the Israeli incursion took place after the close of tabling for oral questions 2 weeks beforehand. And I want to see a Parliament also that is more accessible to the public, more welcoming to the British visitor, or as we call them rather quaintly in Parliament, the strangers. At last, we are making more progress. A feasibility study has been commissioned at long last on an interpretive visitor centre. We've just agreed on professional training for House of Commons guides with a view to ensuring that the visitor does not just get an appreciation of the history and the architecture of Westminster, but gets also some sense of Parliament as a working institution at the heart of our democracy. And I pay tribute, if you will allow me, Richard, to the Hanson Society, and in particular yourself, for your persistent badgering to get Parliament to take full advantage of the immense asset that our building represents and the great opportunity that a visit to it provides for education and citizenship. Of course, change is not always easy. Change will always have its opponents. I was interested to read the other day that when electric lighting was brought into the House of Commons chamber, there were many protests that it looked as if we had daylight in the chamber instead of gas lighting. Any campaign of advance must expect the occasional rearguard action. And we encountered one last week when the House resolved not to put nominations to the select committees on a basis more independent of party control. I'm encouraged that there was a majority for the reform among the Labour MPs who voted. The status quo was protected by a large majority of the Conservative MPs. A number of commentators have since expressed themselves baffled that when offered the chance to vote for greater parliamentary independence, the members of Parliament voted against it. There has been particular perplexity that Conservative MPs voted en masse to preserve the power of the government whips. The explanation of this phenomenon lies in the duality of MPs' role. We're all parliamentarians, but we are also all party politicians, and we're deeply ambivalent as to whether we want Parliament reaching independent decisions or whether we want our party securing its own agenda. And, you know, let me be frank, I'm as deeply torn by this duality as the next man or woman. As an opposition spokesman, I took no prisoners. I've been a loyal member of my party since I was a teenager. I will go to my grave clutching my party membership card as previous generations went to their grave clutching their sword as their most precious possession. So I fully understand the pull of tribal instincts, because I also am a member of the tribe. However, as leader of the House, I've come to recognize that the tribal character of party politics may now be a trap for Parliament. The world outside Parliament has changed. When I first canvassed for the party at 19, when you discovered a Labour voter, you knew the probability was that everyone in the household was Labour. Even more comfortably, you knew that when you went back 4 years later on, they would still all be Labour. Today, you never know how they'll be voting at the next general election. And moreover, many of those who commit themselves to one or other party are not necessarily buying in to the full party's portmanteau of policies. Now, this is entirely healthy. It is good for democracy that electors reserve the right to change their minds from one election to the next. And good also that they reserve the right to think for themselves whatever their party is telling them. But the challenge of the Commons is whether we can adjust to the less tribal society which we are supposed to represent. And it is a real challenge. We may know that the public outside want to see a Commons more concerned with the public interest than with scoring party political advantage. But we also know that we will get reported in the media not on the basis of serious and mildly boring business scrutinizing social policy. We will get reported in the media if we come up with the drama of a good bout of party political mud wrestling. We are stuck with the conundrum that we cannot restore respect for Parliament without airtime, but we cannot get the airtime without displays of the partisan aggression that in the long term lowers respect for Parliament. When I first came to Parliament in 1974, there was only one BBC microphone within half a mile of the chamber. It was literally in a garden shed attached to Abbey Gardens. By the time one of the more ponderous and well-fed BBC interviewers had got round the other side of the table, there was only room for one member of Parliament to be interviewed at a time. The place is now awash with microphones and cameras. There are now 30 accredited BBC journalists. I'm sure they all work jolly hard, and many of them are extremely likeable people. Nevertheless, Parliament was more often in the bulletins 30 years ago when we had one BBC microphone than it is today when we've got 30 BBC reporters. And I don't intend to single out the BBC alone for blame about the present ambiguous relationship between Parliament and the media. The print media must also accept responsibility, especially the allegedly serious print media. Every nation has its version of a tabloid press. What makes Britain unique is that our broadsheet press now faithfully tracks the agenda of the tabloid press. Politics is reported as a soap opera of personality conflict, which puts the spotlight on the process of decision-making by those personalities rather than the outcome of their policies for the nation. This makes it difficult for the press to cover serious issues. There have been breakthroughs in the past 5 years on matters that worry real people. For instance, the virtual abolition of long-term youth unemployment is one of the strongest dividing lines between the history of the 80s and the record of this government. It is also the largest single explanation of the 20% reduction in overall crime. Yet it has gone virtually unremarked in the media. Both press and Parliament now are handicapped by a culture of political reporting that is too introverted and too little about what is going on in the lives of readers and electors. I believe that one of the great achievements of this government is that it has put the patient and the pupil first and has freed public services from capture by producer interests. Ironically, this lesson has yet to be learnt at Westminster, where reporting is still dominated by producer capture. Political reporting reinforces the public impression of a self-preoccupied Westminster village. It is dominated by the issues about which lobby journalists and MPs love to gossip about, to the exclusion of issues which are pressing upon the lives of the public beyond Parliament Square. Jonathan Friedland perceptively pointed out recently that if newspapers were edited by plumbers, they would give prominence to disasters about block drains and street floods. As they are edited by journalists, they give prominence to stories about spin doctors and press officers. That's why the media lovingly detailed every twist, every email, every phone call about which day and at what hour Martin Sixsmith resigned. It is strange that a media which keeps offering itself as an example of a highly competitive industry is so blind to the real interests of its own market. On the night in February, when the media was preoccupied with Stephen Byre's statement on Martin Sixsmith's resignation, the BBC bulletins beyond London and the South East had their lowest ratings for a year as the public switched off. The viewers are literally switching off those media stories of the Westminster village. The risk, what should worry both sides of this debate, whether politicians or whether press, is the risk that the public then also starts to switch off democracy. Philip Gould observed last week that the ratio of negative to positive media stories has increased from 3-1 in 1974 to 18-1 in 2001. And believe me, there was a lot more to write about in a negative way in 1974. I know I was there. Is it any wonder that we have difficulty in restoring faith in democracy as a successful process if the outcome of the process is only reported in terms of failure? And the need to repair popular faith in democracy is underlined by the gathering strength on the continent of far-right extremist parties, basically intolerant, authoritarian, and fundamentally anti-democratic. We need to keep the problem in proportion. Everywhere, they remain a minority of less than one-fifth of the total vote. It is not a common European movement, but is different to every nation. But the emergence of the far right from the further lunatic extremes poses sharp questions to democratic politicians everywhere and challenges our conventional way of doing politics. For example, our concept of political dynamics is rooted in a century of struggle between left and right. And that concept remains a valid shorthand for the choice between the major parties in most European countries. But increasingly, the choice which the electorate is making is between establishment and populism. Parties of the far right are currently thriving by picking up the growing none-of-the-above vote. The challenge for responsible democratic government is to be in power, but not to become trapped in the establishment. Secondly, since Maynard Keynes convinced the opinion formers of his time that government was responsible for the state of the economy, political parties have put economic management at the top of their sales pitch. Only a decade ago, Clinton built his entire campaign on the maxim, "It's the economy, stupid." Yet the challenge we've seen recently from the far right is not based on discontent with economy. The government of the centre-left in the Netherlands has just been put out of office by a dramatic rise in the vote for the far right, despite one of the most prosperous economies in Europe and a rise in GDP of 25% within a decade under that centre-left government. The challenge to mainstream politicians must be to find progressive and inclusive solutions to the politics of insecurity and belonging which authoritarian parties now exploit as fear of crime and hostility to different people. There is another lesson to be absorbed and reflected upon. In the past generation, we have become accustomed to the electoral battleground, which is fought over, being in the centre, where live Mondeo man, Worcester woman, and all the rest of the Pebble Dash people. This fixation has been particularly acute in Britain because our idiosyncratic electoral system ensures that these crucial swing electors are the only ones whose votes really count. Yet the message from the continent is that the struggle for the centre voter is no longer the only contest in town. Continental parties of the left have seen their core voters go straight to the far right without stopping off from the centre. We need to adjust to a different electoral environment, possibly a more healthy electoral environment, in which there is competition for the vote of every community, not just the centrist voters. And we also need to recognise the impact on domestic politics of globalised economics. Globalisation has been great for those with internationally marketable skills. They have seen the price of their labour bid up by a much wider marketplace. It has not been so great for unskilled workers who find themselves in direct competition with cheaper labour anywhere on the face of the globe. Perhaps one of the reasons why we have been more successful in Britain in keeping the far right in check has been the vigorous programme we have pursued to widen access to education and skills and to promote social justice. And despite those pressures of globalisation, we have ensured over the past 5 years that the bottom decile of income earners has received the same percentage increase as the top decile, contrasting vividly with the outcome of the Thatcher years when they got a beggarly 1/30th of the top decile. All of these are challenging issues for politicians to address. They challenge the way in which we have become accustomed to doing things, which is always the most awkward and arresting challenge to face. But the most profound challenge of all is how do we bridge the gap between politicians and people and build a shared reality understood by both? The most brilliant and at the same time the most depressing political tract which I read in the past year is the monograph by Colin Crouch on coping with post-democracy. His central thesis is that mass democracy reached its zenith in the mid-20th century and has been on a descending parabola ever since. Politics is now the property of a political class. It is not seen as the product of a mass movement or under ownership of the people. And the bigger the gulf between electors and elected, the greater my problem, everybody else's problem, in maintaining consensus around parliamentary democracy as the remedy. The problem is particularly acute among young voters. Although they are better educated, better informed, and on the whole have a better financial stake in society than previous generations, Younger voters had an even worse turnout at the general election than the rest of the population. The recent BBC research into public disillusionment came to the depressing conclusion that there was a collective sense of pride among the third of the population that did not vote. We're in danger of it being seen as not cool to vote in parliamentary elections. Now, Richard, those of you who can still recall that I began by saying I'm in an optimistic mood must now be asking yourself, how on earth does he get back to the optimistic mood from here? Well, we can begin to recover that optimism by recognising that democratic ballots are still enthusiastically embraced whenever people believe that their opinions make a difference on issues which directly affect them. There have now been a string of ballots with a high turnout as a result of our initiatives on New Deal communities. From Sheffield to Bristol, the turnout has exceeded 50%, and the turnout in Sheffield was exactly double the previous local government turnout. These are turnouts in ballots, by definition, in some of the most deprived communities which normally have the lowest turnouts. Over the past year, there have now been 26 ballots on the transfer of municipal housing. The average turnout is a staggering 69%, which would be a respectable figure for a general election. In both Birmingham and Glasgow, there was a turnout of 65%. That contrasts with a lower turnout in these cities for the last general election, for the last local elections, and in the case of Glasgow, for the first elections to the Scottish Parliament. Now, there is hope there. People will vote if they believe that the ballot is part of an empowering process. There's no single simple stroke by which Parliament can make elections to it appear equally relevant. But I want to leave with you three steps which I believe must be part of anybody's package. First, MPs must be given space to respond to events as human beings rather than as programmed politicians. We need to try to be less tribal and more individualist in our approach to political debate. Pager politics belongs to the era of collectivism and the command economy of half a century ago. In the consumerist and lifestyle age in which younger voters inhabit, respect goes to personalized responses rather than to party mantras. Secondly, if we are to do that, the media need to resist pouncing on the least spark of originality as a gaffe, or running off to find another MP of the same party to denounce it. No MP will show a spark of originality if we are left living in terror that it will turn into a conflagration of headlines and party splits. Mature and honest debate requires a media that is equally mature and balanced. And thirdly, the Commons, if it wants to be seen as relevant, must be seen to belong to the modern age. It has been unkindly described by one commentator as Hogwarts on Thames. Now, I could not possibly comment. But I do know that our language often appears jargon and our customs Victorian. We need a bonfire of those little pink ribbons which each of us are given on our election on which to hang our swords. And in its place, a determined reform to create a modern parliament that looks and sounds as if we belong to the same century as our electors. Now, Richard, a couple of hundred years ago, a member of the House of Lords heard a colleague refer to the House of Commons and inquired, "Is that going on still?" Well, indeed it is. I fully intend it'll be going on for another couple of hundred years. But it will only do so as the centre of our democracy, holding the government to account, making sure that it gains the universal respect of the population. If it brings the same energy and courage that is already shown in reforming every other part of the Constitution, to reforming and modernising the Commons itself.
Robin, thank you very much for a lecture which we've all been privileged to listen, which I think certainly characterised by both originality and courage, and I'm sure will prompt a lot of questions. Now, I'd just like to suggest one or two conventions for the questions, which is we've got people with microphones, so would you please, if you want to ask a question, indicate, and the microphone bearer will come to you, one of the stewards. Secondly, would you be kind enough to say your name so that help our speaker respond to you? And I think with that, what I'm going to do is to just ask, if I may, Professor Stephen Coleman, who directs a large part of the Hans Sauer Society's e-democracy program, to kick off the discussion with the first question. Stephen.
Well, that was a very interesting talk. And returning to Colin Crouch's point about where Parliament is and whether Parliament is in decline, I wonder whether we are indeed seeing the end of a certain model of democratic representation, whether that's in many respects quite a good thing. And what we are seeing emerge is a much more collaborative model of representation, in which the public has more of a voice, it expects a greater degree of respect, and in which representation becomes something that is in itself more direct, not direct democracy instead of representative democracy, but indeed direct representative democracy. And I wonder whether there are some elements of this moving beyond an old model of representation that Robin Cook would comment on. The language of parliamentary politics. I think most people find it baffling that members of Parliament can't refer to each other by their names. I suspect that they find it baffling that there is a procedure which looks like it belongs more to an age of ritual than to an age of spontaneous and enthusiastic debate. I think there is a concern amongst many people that what they see in the House of Commons doesn't reflect enough the kind of people they see around them in the workplaces and the streets that they live in. And I know that that is a question of such people being elected, and that is a question of parties enabling such people to be elected. But I also think that as that develops, it's something that we will perhaps see become more of a means of engaging people in democracy. And thirdly, and I suppose I think Robin Cook won't be surprised to hear me say this, there's a whole question of using new means of communication in order to connect people and their voices to the democratic process, so that the age-old problem of our representative democracy, that people say, whatever I think, they won't listen to me, is no longer a prevalent thought, and people start to feel that there is an adequate mechanism to feed in to the process of legislative deliberation. I wonder if Robin Cook has any comments to make on those observations.
Thank you.
You want to take one or two in, Richard?
Well, I thought maybe that contained about three questions.
Right, okay, that qualifies as two or
might
three.
Might do that, and then yeah, we'll take them in groups. Yeah.
I was hoping you could deal with it as a multiple-choice question, which I only have to answer one of them. First of all, on the issue of Parliament decline, I think we've got to be very careful that really there is not a golden era from which Parliament has declined in terms of public support. I'm very familiar with that some of the more, I'm looking for words not offensive here, more stuffy of broadsheets are inclined to talk about the 19th century as if it was a great heyday. Parliament, of course, burnt down in the 19th century, and the stories have it that whenever one of the roofs of Parliament fell into the fire, there was a great cheer went up from the London mob who'd gathered to watch this spectacle. So we should not kid ourselves that there's been some golden age in the past when Parliament was held in high affection and respect. It is a constant battle to maintain that respect. On the issue of the way in which we address each other, I have some sympathy for your point. I remember you're dealing here with an old lag who's been there for 30 years. I think you could, I personally would embrace a change in which we address to each other by surname. I think once you get into the informality of Christian names, all sorts of other things start to then happen as the nature of your debate. But, you know, I have been, obviously, a Scottish MP a number of times to the Scottish Parliament. And the Scottish Parliament had a tremendous advantage in that they had what I describe as a Greenfield rule book. They had a blank sheet of paper, whereas I have got 700 years to wrestle with. And they do address each other by surnames. They've decided to discourage people addressing each other by Christian name because that creates too much of an informal atmosphere. But they do actually connect with the public, I think in many ways better than we do, precisely because they do not have between them the barrier of process, the barrier of Victoriana, the barrier of language. There is a commentator in Scotland who actually brought out the line, which is, it's not great praise, but actually I'm afraid it's true. Contrasting Westminster with the Scottish Parliament, he said, the Scottish Parliament may not be inspiring, but at least it is normal. And I think that encapsulates the problem. A lot of what we're seen doing does not appear normal. And indeed, in the modern age, standing up and making a speech to a group of people, potentially 400 people, is an aberrant behavior. That's not the way in which people do business in any other walk of life. I do think that the key to making sure that Parliament remains effective, moves the modern times, and can be seen to be, is to strengthen our committee work in the way that, say, the Scottish Parliament has done. Starting out afresh, the Scottish Parliament has created a structure which is basically committee-based, but with a weekly plenary to take forward the decisions in committee. We have what is basically a plenary system with some committees bolted onto it. And I think over a period of time, you will see a transfer of work, a transfer of priority and importance to the committee work. And interestingly, the Scottish experience is that is much more valued by the members who find the job much more satisfying. On the issue of the question of e-democracy and the use of new technology, as you know, Stephen, I fully share your cautious enthusiasm for this, and I've benefited from your caution also, and I've never forgotten your immortal advice that if you're doing something badly, the only advantage of putting it on the internet is more people know more quickly you're doing it badly. So you know, the new technology does offer us a tool, and politicians have always been interested in communicating. It'd be daft if we did not show an interest in this miraculous, wondrous new way of communicating. But it is a tool. It is not itself a substitute for working out what it is we're wanting to do, what it is we're wanting to say, and what it is we're wanting to consult about. And we've got to get both of those right.
Now, we've got a lot of people trying to get in, so I'm going to ask people if they'd be kind enough to make fairly brief questions. Gentlemen in the balcony on the end of the row there.
Thanks. David Morgan. One area where people do express their satisfaction with members of Parliament is the constituency service that is given. Do you see a conflict between MPs spending a lot of time solving problems at the local level and their role as legislators, particularly when there are such low levels of staffing? And again, as legislators, when they don't have the kind of resources that American congressmen do, having the support of a budget office, of a much larger research service than we have in the Library of the House of Commons.
I think that qualifies as one question, so yes, let's take two or three.
Yeah, I'll take two or three at the same time. Yes. Please, go.
Thank you very much. Bob Marston, could I very briefly disagree with two things before I ask the question?
Hey, first Bob, if you want to disagree with two things, that's real progress in your case.
Thank you, Rob. The first one is how profoundly I disagree with the idea that modernisation has anything to do with the way that we address each other in Parliament, which is entirely to do with the adversarial process. It's very important that we continue to talk about each other, as the Honourable Member was saying. So it's quite difficult to be unpleasant if you're talking about the Honourable Member. If you say, no, it's quite difficult to say, you bastard. When you, when and it's a very important part of the system. And secondly, if I may, Sixsmith. The preoccupation with the press about Sixsmith wasn't about the way that he was sacked. It was about the corruption of democracy, which was represented by Joe Moore, which was much earlier than that, and that it's a government corruption, not a press corruption. But finally, Robin, can I ask you to address this in a very fine address? You never once touched on the corruption of patronage as being part of our democracy, and an awful lot of us believe that one of the great corruptions, not time in the chamber or what we call each other, but the real problem of parliamentary democracy and how it could be modernised, is the problem of patronage within our society. Could I ask you to consider that?
Yeah, well, thank you very much for that, Bob. We'll take one or two more. Yes, gentleman in the middle at the back there.
Andrew Holden from Charterhouse.
Would you mind using the microphone?
Andrew Holden from Charter 88. I congratulate Mr. Cook on his speech as well, which I thought gave challenges to everyone in the political class about how they discuss Parliament. I wonder if I could ask you to say something about devolution and decentralisation. Even with the reformed Parliament, which you're campaigning for and we're campaigning for, a perfect Westminster Parliament probably couldn't be the engine for democratic renewal in a country as highly centralised, particularly as England. You referred to the Scottish Parliament earlier. I wonder if you could say something about how decentralisation and devolution in England obviously needs to go beyond reforming Parliament at Westminster.
Good, thank you very much. And we'll take one more from the balcony, which is the second. I'll come to you if I can later, sir, but this gentleman in the front row here. Just wait for the microphone, will you?
Thank you, and thank you for your speech. Can we infer that with the government moving to abolish hereditary peerage in the House of Lords, that the government might also want to consider abolishing the hereditary monarchy, and if not, why?
Very good. Well, I think that's a very good moment to break for a response from the speaker.
That one's easy. No question whatsoever. There's no danger of us moving against the monarchy, and you ask why? Because there's journalists in the House. I think it's very important that we do get the hereditary peers out of our Parliament. I mean, it's deeply offensive that we have a hereditary principle in our Parliament that passes the laws. There is, as far as I can make out, no other Parliament anywhere in the modern democratic world that still preserves the hereditary principle. And I have been shamed once or twice as a foreign minister complaining about the absence of democracy in various countries around the world and being reminded that where is the democracy in the hereditary right of those who sit in the House of Lords? So it is important we get them out. And until we took 90% of that, they did make a big difference the way in which the votes went. It was the hereditary peers, after all, who basically voted for the poll tax when it went up to the House of Lords. And the difference between that and the monarchy is that the monarch in our system has no lawmaking power, and indeed not since the time of Victoria in the late 19th century is there any evidence that the monarch has ever had any impact whatsoever on the laws that we pass. The laws that we pass are, through Parliament, accountable to the people, and there is quite a clear distinction there. It is a separate argument. It's one in which people have valid and different views, but it's a very separate argument to the question of the House of Lords. Now, on the other points that were raised, I deeply value the constituency service we provide to members. I actually think that one of the strengths of Parliament is precisely that the members of Parliament have to go back and meet real people who are their constituents. And because our constituencies are small, a relatively small number of people in the constituency can make a big impact on a member of Parliament's thinking. I recall when I was the opposition spokesman on health and social security, the then Thatcher government brought in the cuts in housing benefit in the late 80s, which you may recall. And I had put down for an emergency debate on the effect of the cuts. Now, emergency debates are terribly rare in the House of Commons. Speakers tend not to favour them. I think I've had two of the only three in the past decade or so. To my amazement, Speaker Weatherall on that occasion gave me my emergency debate, and so I had great fun turning up the next day and having fun about the cuts in housing benefits. Now, why did he do that? He did it because the previous Saturday he had gotten his Speaker's car and been driven down to Croydon, which was his constituency, to take his monthly surgery, which was usually what Bagshot would have described as more part of the ceremonial part of the Constitution than the functioning part of the Constitution.
and to his consternation found 20 people there waving their housing benefit cuts at him. I came back to the House of Commons, granted debate, we had a 3-hour debate on it, and great fun it was indeed. Now, I think it is terribly important that members of Parliament should get in that position where they have to go back out and see what the real problems are worrying real people. You then have to be realistic about what parallels you can draw. You referred it to congressmen and the resources. Congressmen represent electorates 10 times greater than ours. Need a bit more support in those circumstances. But I think you lose an enormous amount by that much greater scale on which they have the constituency and their electorates. Is there a conflict between what we do in our constituencies and Parliament? As I've said, I think they can be mutually reinforcing. If you want to have members of Parliament who can actually do sensible things in Parliament, they need to know what's going on in the real world. In the present circumstance, there has undoubtedly been a shift, certainly over my lifetime, from the amount of time in Parliament against the amount of time in the constituency. But, you know, if I'm honest about that, this is not an institutional issue, it is not a reform issue, it's not a procedural issue. It's a reflection of the brute fact of life that with the present majority of the government, there is no pressure to be present and to be voting in the House of Commons. If you had a small majority as we had in 1974, or as happened in 1975, no majority at all when we found John Stonehouse swimming trunks, you would then have to be there all the time and the balance will shift back again. And it may be a case, here I'm going into serious originality mode, it may be part of the case for changing the electoral system, because I have heard until I'm sick of it the phrase that the first-past-the-post system gives us strong government, and indeed it does. What it actually does give you those strong majorities in the House of Commons, and I think the strong majority itself is becoming a problem for the House of Commons and the way that it works. Now, Bob, I'll happily settle for having convinced you on the rest. I mean, I think that's as good a score as I've ever had with you. I agree with you about the adversarial system, though, and indeed, since you're a barrister, I can't resist pointing out that what we have in the House of Commons is a culture very close to the adversarial system of the English court system. And there are legitimate grounds of debate as to whether the adversarial court system is the best way of establishing the truth. And I'm not too sure it's necessarily the best way of establishing the public interest in the House of Commons. I mean, most of the world do not live the way our barristers do, having adversarial confrontations all day at business. Much business nowadays is based on rewarding those who try and work together as a team and trying to find a common solution, even if they come at it from different perspectives. And I think the House of Commons has got to be sensitive to that change that's going on in the world around us. On the issue of patronage, whether you're inside the patronage or outside the patronage tends to colour your view on it, and it has been with us for a very long time. But there has been a change which I noted over my lifetime in that patronage was once used to steal critics and to recruit critics, which is not unhealthy because it meant you were always bringing in to the centre of the executive people who had different perspectives and different contacts and different constituencies of interest. The pressure for conformity, which we've had now from the modern media, makes it very difficult for prime ministers to take the kind of bold gambles that Harold Wilson used to do by bringing in people who had criticised him. And I think that that is a weakness in the system. It's not patronage itself. It is the way in which the present structures oblige patronage to be used. Lastly, Richard, on the question of centralisation, I'm fully for achieving more decentralisation from the centre. England, and I say England advisedly, not Britain, England is now by far the most centralised state in Europe, with the possible exception of France, but at least France, thanks to the French Revolution, has a long tradition of civic mayors, which we do not have. And I think that that is a problem for all politicians. I hope that the proposals we've made for regional assemblies directly elected will take on and will result in a challenge to that degree of centralisation. But that is now down to the English themselves. They have to decide with what enthusiasm they're going to pick up that and run with it.
Thank you very much, Robin. I'm told, can I just do a sort of straw poll? I'm told people at the back are having a bit of trouble hearing Robin and myself. I think it's probably because we're not quite close enough to the microphone.
Is that any better? Yeah. Oh, okay, very good. Jolly good.
Thank you very much. Now, let's just take one or two more. I've got this gentleman in the balcony, two from the balcony, one there and one there. So if we could take No. Rather, you had the microphone.
Thank you, Chair. Martin Green, surely one antidote to apathy, Robin, is to have the Euro referendum at the time of the next election, which has the added bonus of strengthening Britain's negotiating position inside the EC in the interim period. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And at the other end of the row, if the microphone could be transferred along there. I have to say, it's not innate chauvinism, but I'm not doing too well with women questioners so far, but I've got one there and one there. We'll come to you in a moment. Thank you very much.
Jim Addington, Action for UN Renewal. My question relates to the ability of Parliament to make decisions at a crucial moment, in other words, before we go to war. You will recall that after the Kosovo War, the Select Committee on Foreign Affairs called on the government to permit a debate on a substantive motion, the ability to amend, and the ability to take a vote. This perhaps has some connection with the idea of MPs having a pink ribbon on which to hang their swords. But my question, of course, is to make sure that the government doesn't go to take the sword up before the members have the democratic right to make the decision.
Yes, thank you very much. Now, is there one from the body of the Kirk down here? I've got a sort of slight prejudice in favour of female questioners, but I don't see one down here. I'll take the gentleman at the back.
Glenn Siegel, would you not agree that Parliament is accountable to the people, and in order to enhance this accountability and increase voter turnout in elections, that the best method forward would be proportional representation as a reform of the system?
Yes, thank you. Would you like to?
Yeah. First of all, Martin, referendums come under the sort of the monarchy rule. You know, it's a very dangerous territory to discuss it in public among consenting adults. And one of my colleagues doesn't hold, of course. I mean, if you want the mantra, I shall repeat the mantra. But this is a classic case where the least variation from the mantra, even moving the comma in the sentence, can result in a split story in tomorrow's papers. And so, you forgive me, I'll pass on this. I mean, this is far too intelligent and sensible and thoughtful an audience to be treated to 3 minutes of mantra. On the question of should Parliament take a decision on military action, I mean, first of all, I think there is a problem with Parliament in that we get exercised about issues when they are facing us, and then we move on to the next issue once it's out of the way. If Parliament is going to change that procedure and that rule, Parliament will need to do it in the cool, calm light of a situation in which there is no immediate impending war. We always remember it again when there is the next decision required on committing military troops. But whilst I recognise that there is a bona fide issue of procedure here, the brute reality remains the same. No Prime Minister, whatever his technical powers in terms of the Crown prerogative, can commit British troops to heavy engagement if he is not confident he would command a majority within the House of Commons. And there are other ways than anything so unsubtle as a division to demonstrate that. In fairness to this government, we had many debates, 6 full days of debate on the commitment of troops to Afghanistan. And although none of those had a substantive motion or a substantive vote, nobody actually could doubt what the will of the House was on those occasions. Lastly, I was asked about turnout and proportional representation. Well, this is a softball for me. Proportional representation is an issue in which my heresy is so well known it's now ceased to be original and worrying to the press. I'm totally signed up to proportional representation, and I have been ever since Margaret Thatcher was elected for the second time and a 42% share of the vote. I also do agree with you that there is some evidence that it could have an impact on turnout. It is interesting that the two democratic countries with the lowest turnout are the two countries which still cling to the first-past-the-post system, namely the United States and the United Kingdom. One of the clear messages that comes back from people who didn't vote is they didn't think their vote mattered. And I'm bound to say, you know, in truth, in a number of places, that is true. I mean, if you live in Liverpool Garstang,
Your vote really doesn't matter that much. I mean, you're still going to get a Labour MP whatever way you vote, and you're still going to get only the one Labour MP even if you go along and vote for the Labour candidate. And I am genuinely worried about the distortion of our political debate around the swing voter and the crucial marginal seats. I think that it is very important, if we're going to tackle the 39% Tanner and Liberal Garstang, that we make it clear to these people that the vote does make a difference. You know, terrific that they want to vote Labour. We'd like to see 89% of them voting Labour. And if 89% of them voted Labour, it would have an effect on the overall composition of the House of Commons. And I think that's a very important democratic principle, which could have an impact on turnout.
When I used to go around making speeches on proportional representation, after I said Liverpool Garstang will always have a Labour member, I said, on the other hand, if you vote in Guildford and Surrey, you know you'll always have a Tory member. Now, we're going to take these ladies from the balcony who are trying to get in the middle first. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. June Beck. You have deplored, and I think we all deplore in this hall, the fact that there's such a low turnout, lack of enthusiasm, particularly perhaps among the under-35s. But on the other hand, very often when one visits Parliament, there's very, very few MPs sitting in the chamber. So how can you expect the electors to be enthusiastic if the MPs show very marked lack of enthusiasm for attending debates?
Yes, thank you for that. And then we've got along in this row here,
Sarah Morgan. As a politics student, we're often given the bad side as well as a politics student, we're often given the bad side as well as the good side of politics. And although the Commons, the changes to the select committees that are being looked at the moment are very good, what about giving select committees the opportunity to be able to call for ministers and civil servants and enforce it to be able to effectively scrutinise, rather than just having the piecemeal scrutiny that we have at the moment? And what about legislation that allows them then to say, OK, we've scrutinised, now let us do something about it, rather than handing in reports, which very often will get ignored as far as the public can see anyway?
Thank you.
Is there anything being done about that, and will there be anything done?
Thank you very much. Now, Michael Parker here in the front row.
Thank you very much, Michael Parker. Can I join the chorus of praise for that extremely candid, refreshingly candid speech? Thank you very much indeed, Robin Cook. You spoke about your enthusiasm for the possibilities of voter renewal, in effect. You said that when voters could see some empowerment, they were willing to vote. Could I ask you to address, really rather along the lines that the last two speakers have been raising, that the problem of parliamentary power as such, the possibility that people are not voting, especially young people are not voting, because they don't really think that Parliament has sufficient clout to make it worthwhile. After quite a long career teaching politics to young people, trying to enthuse them about the business of parliamentary government, I have to say, sadly, that an awful lot of my pupils proved resistant to the idea of voting because they said it didn't really matter. The House of Commons wasn't where it really was being settled.
Thank you very much. And in this batch, we'll just take one more. Yes.
Thank you very much. Kate Jenkins. I wanted to raise the question, which I think follows to some extent from the previous two questions, about the apparent relative ineffectiveness of most of the mechanisms of accountability in the Commons. On the Hansard Commission, we spent a lot of time thinking really very hard about how to make select committees more effective and how to give them some kind of structure which enabled them to genuinely hold to account the executive in a way that not only the committees could feel satisfied with, but also their constituents, the public. I think I still haven't yet heard anything that would reassure me that the 20 years that I spent in the civil service partly drafting brush-away reports in answer to select committee reports is ever going to be any different. I think one of the most critical things for the modernisation function in Parliament to face up to is how Parliament's holding to account can be genuinely a fist around the neck of the executive and not simply something which can simply be brushed away with no great difficulty on the part of professionals.
Thank you very much. Robin.
First of all, on the question of attendance in the chamber, can I just say most members of Parliament, not everyone in any average or any representative figure, there's going to be variations, but most members of Parliament put in a 60-hour week. That is the reality. Of those 60 hours, maybe in a typical week, 10% would actually be spent in the chamber. To be perfectly frank, if I found a member of Parliament who had been in the chamber from 2:30 until the division at 10, I would be deeply suspicious whether he or she was doing their job, because there's so much else to be done in committee work, so much else to be done for the constituency, so much else to be done as a party animal, meeting the members of your party and making sure that you actually are developing the policy for the future. So I would not expect to find the chamber crowded all day long, and frankly, I would worry about my own constituency MP if he was there all day long. That is not to say that the House will not become a full House when there is a matter of interest there on which the outcome is uncertain. I mean, a good example was last Tuesday when we debated state committees, when I had a very full House for the speech in which I presented our reforms. And the reason why people were there is there was an issue on which they were not clear what the outcome would be, and there was that uncertainty, unpredictability. I think that if we had a situation in which, to take the question of proportional representation, you would see more of that kind of interest in being there because the outcome was less certain. Just as during the 1974 Parliament, we had massive attendances because time after time it would turn literally on one vote. But in any other circumstance, I think you're quite right, the members should be elsewhere. I talked earlier that we should try and move towards more of a committee-based system of making decisions. You can't have a more of a committee-based system with everybody sitting in the chamber all day long. On the issue of state committee powers, state committees have powers to call ministers, and by God, they do, and quite right to do so. And there is no select committee that is complaining about their access to their departmental ministers. They get them, and believe me, there would be trouble if they did not, and it would result then in a matter of a decision on the floor of the House. However, there is a separate issue, which is also the one that Kate raised here, which is to what extent does their work in select committees make a difference? I don't think you were there as a civil servant when I was there as a minister, and maybe cultures have changed since you were there, and I certainly think it's probably true that civil servants are more relaxed about select committees than ministers up until the point when those civil servants discover they've got to appear in front of the select committee and give oral evidence, at which point a quite different cultural approach comes from the civil servants, and we say so, Kate. Let me tell you, ministers do not regard with enthusiasm and delight the prospect of appearing again before a select committee on a difficult issue. That's entirely the way it should be. We should worry if it was otherwise. They are taken very seriously by ministers as a body that can carry out investigative tasks, that can come up with different perspectives. Where I think the select committees will find, as a result of last week's package, that they have real change in power and balance, is if we can secure one of my key objectives, which is more draft legislation to be considered in draft, preferably, doesn't have to be, but preferably by the appropriate departmental select committee, that will result in real power for those committees because they can then change the shape of it. They can have an impact on what is subsequently published. And the real strength of the committee system in the Scottish Parliament is precisely that every bill goes to them in draft first before being published. I was then asked by Michael about how do we get people to understand that their vote matters. Now, there's an obvious logical, rational answer to that. Governments do matter. Whoever is in government does make a big difference. When that woman upbraided Tony Blair during the election outside the Birmingham hospital, she was subsequently given an interview in which she said she never voted. It doesn't matter. They're all the same. David Aronovich went through the life this woman has been through and the number of general elections that have passed by in which she did not vote, and they include, for the sake of example, Michael Foot and Margaret Thatcher, Neil Kinnock and Margaret Thatcher. Now, one can have your different views on these figures, but you can't possibly argue they're the same. or that the government that they led would have done the same things. They are patently different. They are a valid choice. I think what is really being said by those who say they're all the same is they are perceiving politicians as a class who occupy a very different place in society, in thought processes, and in interest to them as electors and as members of the public. And that's the real problem, I think, is the disconnection between the people who are elected and the people who we would really rather like to get out and do the electing. And there's no longer that sense of being one seamless process under the same ownership as there probably was in 1945 and 1950 and 51. And that's the biggest single test to us, which is to find the language, the style, the interests, the mode of operating, so that they can look on politicians not as some sort of separate beast that has landed on a spaceship from Mars, but as also part of the same society, sharing similar views and similar concerns to them, and people whom they can trust to represent them, not simply intellectually, but in terms of their emotional and general feelings in society.
Robin, are you happy to take one last batch?
Sure, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Depends what they ask us.
A lady.
Thank you. Sorry.
I'm sorry. Behind you.
Angela Franklin. I certainly hope that all your proposed reforms come about as soon as possible, including proportional representation. And I also would like to add, I'd love to hear that England has an equal position as Scotland and Wales and so on, and not just regional, but centred in Westminster, of course, which has been the centre of government for England for 1,000 years or so. But we've touched on here, and everyone has for ages everywhere, touched on the problem of lack of respect for an interest in the workings of the House of Commons and MPs and so on. I wonder if you could perhaps address a little bit what I see as the problem of the lobby fodder. You've said on the one hand that if you saw the MPs sitting in the chamber all day, you'd think they weren't doing their job. Now, isn't it easy for people to see that MPs voting, on the whole and usually, is just a great big sham? And the fact that they have to actually get up from whatever they're doing when the bell rings, and they're very busy, you say, and I believe you, and interfere with that work to put themselves there bodily to vote, whereas in their minds they may not. I've heard them get up from meetings mumbling, they hardly even know what the thing is about, much less, you know, they haven't got formed their own opinion, they haven't been there to listen to the debate, the party says what you vote for, and they do. So couldn't that be reformed a bit?
Thank you very much. Robert Hazel.
Robert Hazel from the Constitution Unit at UCL. One other possible reason for optimism in Parliament this week, which is worth mentioning, is the vote in the House of Lords yesterday to approve the reform package proposed by your counterpart, Gareth Williams, in the Lords, which is broadly comparable to the modernisation programme that you described for the Commons. And can I just press you on one item in common between your respective reform programmes, top of both your lists, which is pre-legislative scrutiny of more draft bills. Everyone's in favour of this. Gareth Williams proposes that almost all government bills... should be published in draft. That wasn't my hesitation. But I don't think it's generally realised by people outside the world of government how difficult this particular proposal, desirable though it is going to be to deliver in practice. It's not something you on your own can deliver. The Leader of the House himself doesn't introduce bills. It's entirely down to your departmental colleagues. And all of them have pressing reasons in relation to many bills why that particular bill is not only important but also very urgent, and there's no time for it to go through a stage of pre-legislative scrutiny. Can you tell us a bit more about what sanctions or incentives you might be able to offer to your colleagues, particularly perhaps in your role as chair of the Cabinet Committee in charge of the legislative programme.
Thank you very much. The gentleman in the green top.
Yes, I was just wondering whether it had been considered having the parliamentary affairs televised on a channel available to all throughout the day, and whether that would enhance or do damage to the image of Parliament.
Like C-SPAN in the US?
Yes, available to all, no particular commentary, just there for people to tune into if they came across it.
And then a distinguished parliamentary figure immediately in front of you.
Not distinguished, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Nigel Spearing, declare an interest as 27 years a member, not a member now, retired, and 9 years of which were chairman of a select committee. Just to comment on the last one, I voted against television unless every town hall had it on a screen where citizens could go. I think that would be a very good idea. Not only that, because people who speak, four or five experts in the chamber, can sometimes have a very good debate, get to the centre of a point. I want to ask Robin two short questions. The first is, would he agree with me that when BBC reports Parliament, those 30 ladies and gentlemen should always try and say the constituency for which the member comes? Because lots of people know places and they then hear the member, they say, oh yes. It links the member with the place they represent. And we're all there, and we're all there to represent people. That's the first point. The second one is slightly worrying. When Mr. Jopling introduced his reforms, many of us on the back benches were unhappy, particularly with the elimination of ballot for private members' motions. You can debate in an adjournment, but you cannot bite with a vote. And that has gone. It hasn't been brought back. I hope it would be. And I think that Mr. Robin, in his capacity, put this a question to him. He's first, he's a member of the Cabinet, he's a member of the Executive. Is not chairmanship of procedure committees, including modernisation, a conflict of interest? He may not be looked back on as having cooked a house, as Jopling was Jopling the house, but it could be that a future leader of the house might not be so responsible.
Thank you very much, Nigel. I'll take one final question from the balcony. Yes, the lady in the front row in the blue top.
My question is very short. If the voting continues to decline, would we ever consider having a compulsory vote as they do in Australia? Would this be useful or would it be self-defeating?
Good, thank you very much. Robin.
Well, on the last point, I'm not in favour of compulsory voting. I mean, I think you have to have the pressure on politicians to convince people that they're worth people going out and voting for. And I have a bit of a nervousness that if you had compulsory voting in, for instance, some of the continental countries that have recently had ballots, the additional 25% that have been forced out to vote under compulsion will be the ones most likely to vote for one of the non-mainstream parties, which would compound one of the difficulties we have at the present time. Going back to the starting point on the question of lobby fodder and is it all a sham, there is a balance to be struck here. Starting point of that is that we fight general elections as political parties. And indeed, realistically, there ain't any other way in which you can fight them. There's no possible way in which you can deal with an electorate of some 30 million other than the way in which there is a party program and you're voting for the candidate who offers the party program you most identify with. Having done that, you are perfectly entitled to expect that candidate to support the party program which he was elected. And you are perfectly entitled to be thoroughly cheesed off if, having voted for somebody in the Labour program, he spends all his time voting against that Labour program. That is not an honest bargain with the electorate. At the same time, it is perfectly right to expect of members an application of independent and free thought when they are faced with something which was not in the manifesto, or which was the manifesto, but fairly low case and really was not a matter on which the election turned. And the important task is that we should have a parliamentary system which delivers what you voted for, but at the same time gives you people who have a sufficient independent streak of mind to be capable of saying, well, no, this is wrong with this, I will not put up. I will not put, yes. Well, you know what I mean. You know what I mean anyway, yes. And a rebellion from your party discipline is a very important part of a parliamentary process, but it must be a rebellion from the party discipline. It must not become a total free-for-all in which you don't pay any attention to what the electorate actually voted for. Now, Robert characteristically asked an extremely intelligent and well-informed question, and I'm not sure I have the answer to Robert. I mean, you're quite right. Problems of achieving draft legislation are going to be enormous, partly because they're institutional and partly because they're about political will. One clear bottleneck is that there are only 37 people in the Parliamentary Draftsman's Office as Parliamentary Draftsman. Now, that is quite a serious eye of the needle to get my camel through. And they are very busy people. I mean, no disrespect to other civil servants, but I don't actually think there's anyone in Whitehall who works longer hours than the Parliamentary Draftsman. We had one recent occasion of a bill published in second reading where the draftsman actually stayed in all weekend and did not sleep the night before it went to the printers. A tremendous dedication and a very strong sense of reward because it's intellectually a very satisfying job to do. But there aren't enough of them, and I can't simply blow a whistle and produce another 37. It takes years to build that up. We have an ambition to increase them to 42. That's a big step forward, that, actually. It was a struggle. So there is that constraint. Second constraint is within departments there is enormous pressure to focus on the bill they've got at the moment. Ministers are preoccupied, ministers are under pressure, the departmental lawyers are under pressure, the parliamentary clerks under pressure. Wandering along, as I might, and say, let's think a year ahead, is likely to get me shown the door in these circumstances. So there's a big capacity issue. I mean, and ideally, I should just shut down Parliament for a year, which would give us the space to get the bills that we can then take forward as draft bills, but I'm not going to do that, and I think that would get sacked anyway. But it would be totally irresponsible, and one couldn't contemplate that. But to try and get these hard-worked people to do a whole extra year's work while still coping with what they're doing normally is difficult. Now, I think we can get there. It will take years. I mean, I literally mean years before we get to the point I want to arrive at which draft bills are the norm, not the exception. You asked about the incentive. The great incentive to any department, and I've noticed it's beginning to work with one or two, is that they know there's an implicit contract that if they get their draft bill published next session, then they're bound to be at the front of the queue for the next session. Whereas if they don't, they're not necessarily going to get picked for that very small group of people who go forward with the bill. And I think with time we'll get there, but it will take time. On the broadcasting of Parliament, I mean, there is a parliamentary channel. I regret to say it went bust because not enough people watched it, but it was rescued by the BBC as a public service, and it does provide a very good service. We are now looking at ways in which we can provide webcasting on the internet of committee proceedings, and although that's never going to be a mass interest, there are out there lobby groups with a particular interest in the subject being followed by the Select Committee. I think quite proper that they should be able to plug in an internet and see it actually live on their internet and their WPC. So I think that's quite good, and we can do more of that. It will always be a minority interest. What worries me rather more, frankly, is the coverage of Parliament on the mass television, the terrestrial channels, which is declining. There is a great irony. I mean, I voted the other way from Nigel, the voting of and the televising of Parliament, but there is a great irony that we now get less into the television bulletins since we televised Parliament than we used to in the old days when you had a still photograph of Parliament with the voiceovers. And in those days, we were more in the news than we are now, partly because so much of the media now want to report politics as a personality issue, not as a procedural issue from the chamber. Nigel, I have some sympathy with the point you make about private members' motions. The reason Jopling jacked it in was because they had become abused by many members, not yourself, as simply a notice board on which to pin a party political notice. One of the odd consequences of going over to debating private members' concerns on motions for the adjournment, as we do in Westminster Hall, is that the motions actually, the debates, the subject of the debates, tend to be of much more general interest, do respond to real issues, and tend to be actually rather less party political than when they were based around a substantive motion. But there is a big challenge, which I'm very conscious of, that we have to find more space within the parliamentary proceedings for matters that are raised on the initiative of private members rather than raised on the initiative of the executive or indeed the official opposition. Is there a conflict in my role? Yes, there's a conflict in my role. I mean, I'm a bit of a double agent. I'm the executive's voice in Parliament and Parliament's voice in the Cabinet. And you know, as is the case when you're a double agent, sometimes you know, you have to carry a message to one or the other that the other didn't particularly want to hear in the first place. But I do actually think it important that the Leader of the House is doing that role, because this is not a select committee like any other select committee where our task is to produce a report which is a good, trenchant, well-written report which then provides a basis for debate. This is a committee about making progress, getting results, and that does mean negotiating, touching bases, and brokering and horse-dealing. We've made some good progress so far. I hope we can make further progress, and I certainly intend to carry on as chair of the Modernisation Committee, doing all I can until one or other side of these two ends of my dual life catch me up.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Robin. Sadly, that brings the evening to a close. I would like to thank again Ian Burns and the Stationery Office very warmly for their sponsorship. I'd like to thank all those who asked such penetrating questions, and apologies to those who didn't manage to get in. I'm sorry about that, but we did manage to get quite a lot of questions to Robin, and I really would like to thank him on your behalf, not just for an extremely distinguished lecture, and I must say I'm looking forward to reading it and not simply hearing it, because it was very rich in content, but also for the extremely open and penetrating way in which he answered the questions from the floor. I think that that's really a test of a real reformer, that he can sustain it beyond the text of his lecture into the sort of answers he gave to questions. So thank you very much indeed, Robin. You might think it's a very simple thing to get out of this building, but Sam, our senior steward, just wants to give you one or two instructions. Sam.
Good evening. I first wanted to welcome everyone to attend our reception, which is going to be held on the sixth floor in the Shaw Library. Second, to exit, just to make it a little bit easier for everyone, especially the upstairs, if we could have the left side of the room exiting first along with our speakers, and then slowly following all the way to the right. Thank you.
I can't resist telling you that it's on my way in a very nice and solicitous security man advised me where the emergency door was at the back of the stage in case you all rioted. I had faith in you that you were not likely to do it, and thank you very much for being a courteous audience.
Yes, good.